Hi, and welcome to Life in Balance, the official podcast of Balance for Blind Adults. I'm your host, Naomi Haslett. I work as an occupational therapist for Balance. This podcast is about all the things that help people who are blind or living with partial sight live life to the fullest. Each episode, we will speak to someone with lived or professional experience about tips and tricks for how to adapt everyday activities to vision loss, either for yourself or for your loved ones. So come along and listen to learn about living life in balance. For today's episode, I sat down with Lisa Jaranchinovich, a social worker and counselor who runs her own business, Counseling with Lisa. We chat about mental health, the stigma around it, counseling options, and other opportunities where we can take care of ourselves both physically and mentally. We've linked Lisa's website in our show notes if you'd like to learn more about her or access her services. Here she is.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by telling the listeners a little bit about you?
Sure. So my name is Lisa Jaranchinovich. My career is I'm a registered social worker and I have my own private counseling practice. I also live with vision loss. I was diagnosed at age 4 with RP and then re-diagnosed in my early 20s with Bardet-Biedl syndrome. So it's a progressive genetic eye disease. And right now I use a white cane and I use JAWS to access the computer.
Thank you. Where to get started? Maybe can you talk a little bit about how you got interested in social work and counseling?
Sure. So I actually didn't start out in social work. I actually started out taking a degree in English literature at the University of Toronto. At that point, I wanted to be a writer. But I sort of shortly came to the conclusion that I wasn't good enough to be a writer and that I also didn't have the self-discipline it takes to be a writer. So I had to kind of think, you know, what else did I want to do? And during that time, I had been participating in a peer support group where I was helping to co-facilitate. And I really enjoyed that experience. And so that led me towards considering social work. And so then I went to Ryerson and did an undergrad and a master's program in social work there. And during my master's degree, I did a counseling placement and I found it really rewarding. So then after I graduated, I did do some community work where it was more group facilitation based. And that is still something that I do. I do that with Balance and then I've done that with other groups as well too. But now I kind of focus more on my counseling one-on-one work. And so that, you know, has been something that has really, you know, been an opportunity that I've quite enjoyed as a social worker.
Mm-hmm. You use your lived experience as well as something you draw on in your work. Can you talk a little bit about how that comes together Sure. with the academic or the practical professional side?
For sure. I think ideally it's great when, you know, a worker does use their lived experience as well as their professional experience. And in general, I mean, you know, we still are people. So even if we don't have the same lived experience as the people we're working with, we still bring a lot of ourselves and our values into the work. And so for me, you know, working with the partially sighted and blindness community, when that is my lived experience, I can definitely, you know, relate to what people are going through. I've gone through some of what, you know, some of my clients have gone through myself. So there's definitely a connection and an understanding that sometimes I don't find with other counselors. But I also have to be aware that my experience is not the only experience of vision loss. I was born with sight. So someone who is born blind, we have a different experience. And then also looking outside of just the vision loss, you know, I've worked with people who, even though we might have the vision loss in common, there's lots of other aspects of our social identity that are different. So just, I always have to be aware of both the similarities and the differences when I'm working with someone.
Can you speak to, are there kind of common situations or experiences that come up? Of course, keeping in mind that everyone is so different, right? Yes. But in your experience, are there certain challenges that come up on a frequent basis?
So looking more sort of at the people who have more of the progressive vision loss or maybe sudden vision loss, there is a commonality between the adjustment process and so sort of needing to think of themselves as someone who is visually impaired, partially sighted, or blind, whatever term they want to use, as opposed to thinking of themselves as a sighted person. And that's experience that I found that a lot of people struggle with. But when they can sort of switch that perspective, it can be really an opportunity for that acceptance and growth.
How so?
Because a lot of times I find people are still trying to do things in a way as if they were a sighted person. So they're trying to use their limited amount of vision, and their limited amount of vision is not really enough vision to do what they want to do. Whereas if they were, you know, to try and maybe do it in a more tactile or hearing way, then it would, you know, it might be more successful. And just also it can be a way of trying to hang on to things in terms of, you know, how we think of ourselves. And, you know, not that we have to think of ourselves as being disabled, but just sort of, you know, having that feeling of acceptance can bring about a letting go of some of the barriers that we might have around how we think of ourselves. So it can actually make things easier sometimes.
Right. I like your point that you made about trying to do things a certain way, right? Mm-hmm. That you're used to, or that is, you know, an able-bodied person may go about doing it. Mm-hmm. And then to think, you know, if I can accept my situation, I can move forward and do things in a way that works for me.
Yeah.
This is trying to fit, you know, my identity and my life into the box that I used mm-hmm. to be in, right?
For sure. Yeah, because I mean, it's not to say that everything that we used to do, we can't do anymore. But there might be things that you can do, but you have to do them differently. And it's finding that way of how to do it differently that can really be, you know, again, that opening or that opportunity to find a way to do the things that you want to do or that you used to do.
Right. And I think this brings me to another topic, which is, you know, counseling, or at least I think a lot of people might have the impression that counseling is very person-centered or mm-hmm. oriented around what the person can change. But there's a lot of things that are going on in society that mm-hmm. would affect someone coming in for counseling. Mm-hmm. So can you speak a little bit to, you know, ableism or disableism, mm-hmm. what's going on in our society in Canada?
Sure.
I know that's a very big topic, but, you know, how is the world around your clients mm-hmm. influencing their thoughts, their feelings about themselves, or just anything mm-hmm. in general?
Definitely. So there's many levels that ableism affects the person. And, you know, so there's the systemic levels. There's more of the institutional levels. There's the family levels. And then there's the individual levels. And so all of these are interacting at the same time. And, you know, ableism, it looks at the discrimination and harassment of people with disabilities. But it also looks at the limiting of opportunities and the barriers that people with disabilities face. And sometimes these can be attitudinal barriers. And those attitudinal barriers can come from people, you know, outside of us in society. They can come from our family members, or they can even also come from ourselves. So understanding what those attitudinal barriers are and how they affect, you know, our experiences can be a way to sort of shift sometimes how we're feeling and how we're behaving and what we're thinking of.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that sometimes people would work through with you in the mm-hmm. session?
Definitely, yes. I will definitely label when someone is talking about something that might be ableism, you know, and it's something that I talk about a lot with my clients. You know, can contribute to a lot of emotions. You know, it can bring about anger or sadness or grief or frustration. And, you know, all of those things, sometimes, you know, we try and figure out where they're coming from, and the person might blame themselves for what they're feeling. Yet when we bring that social lens into it, it can open it up and give a different perspective to what the person is experiencing.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I'm thinking about when people come to see you for counseling, what do you usually do to help them prepare, or what can they expect in terms of how the process works?
Mm-hmm. So depending, sometimes I will have a short conversation with a person before we start our first session. And that is to give them a little bit of information about what the counseling process is like and what my style is and what they can expect. And then also they can ask any questions. So sometimes that happens. Sometimes we go straight to the first session. And within the first session, there is the structure of, you know, kind of doing some questions to get information from them about what their past experiences have been like. I usually also ask if they have any specific counseling goals that they want to work on. And that can be very general or it can be very specific. And based on that, we just kind of keep going. And I mean, the counseling process at its base is a conversation. And so it's a give and take between myself as the counselor and the client. And, you know, so we just talk about what they're experiencing, what their day-to-day is like, and kind of take it from there. And it sort of kind of flows from one topic to the other.
So it's, I want to say unstructured, but it's not exactly. Maybe the better word is it's that the client is in the driver's seat when it comes mm-hmm. to what they want to talk about yeah. and what they want to work through. And your mm-hmm. role is to, well, maybe you'd be best at telling me what you feel like your role is in that conversation.
Sure. So I see myself as sort of like a guide on their journey. So I keep track of where we've been and where we're going. And so I might, you know, if we've been doing multiple sessions, I might talk about like, okay, so last time, you know, we talked about this, where are you with that? You know, or, you know, your goal was to work on this, where are we with that? But definitely, you know, if there's something that the person wants to talk about, you know, that's very urgent to talk about that day, that is where I start from. And yeah, I would say my approach is definitely not very structured. There might be some counselors who have a more structured approach than I do, but mine is a little bit more kind of following where the conversation goes. I feel that like if we go from one topic to another, that's where the conversation needed to go.
And do you ever find that people are kind of hesitant to try counseling, or they have fears or concerns?
For sure. I mean, you know, they're telling their life story to someone that they don't know anything about. So it can sometimes feel like a very vulnerable situation. Sometimes just even making that first inquiry, you know, that first phone call or email can be the hardest part. So sometimes, you know, when you have started to talk to someone and you feel like you're being listened to and you feel like you have a space to talk about things that you might not have anyone else to talk about, it can relieve some of those fears or concerns at first.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like there's a bit of that first step can be a little bit scary
yeah.
for a lot of sure. people. It's like you said, you're mm-hmm. going and talking a lot of things that are on your mind are quite private to somebody who's a stranger in that mm-hmm. moment. So
yeah. I guess the other thing to reassure people is that everything within the counseling process, except for certain limitations, is confidential. So I'm not going to talk to my friends about, you know, what my clients are telling me. There's very strict limits on when and how I can break confidentiality. And those instances where I would break confidentiality are very specific. And I actually tell everyone before we start our first session what the limits to confidentiality are. It's part of my opening spiel.
Yeah, and that's I'm sure that yeah, it's reassuring. It may be that if somebody hasn't done counseling before, it's mm-hmm. that you're right. That's something that a person may not be familiar with the structure and the professional boundaries and things like that. So mm-hmm. makes sense. Taking a different direction. Mm-hmm. I know we talked about your counseling work. I guess here's a big question for you. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on what, you know, thinking about vision and mental health, like what experiences or what things have you come across in either your professional or your personal experience that affects the community, if there's anything in particular? So for example, like I'm thinking about blindness and mental health and mm-hmm. what are, you know, unique needs of the community. So to give you an example, I've heard that, and it's a really unfortunate fact or statistics, but I heard a lot of people would say they'd rather die than go blind, right? Mm-hmm. So I've heard things like that in terms of coping with adjusting the disability. Mm-hmm. I know you already talked about specific issues your clients have come to you with, but I guess, do you have any comments on mental health in the blind and partially sighted community in general?
I don't know. It's kind of a hard question to answer. I don't have any hard stats on what the percentage of people with partial sight or blindness with mental health problems. There's different levels. So, you know, there's someone who might be just experiencing some stress or some ableism and need someone to talk to. There might be someone who's experiencing, you know, trouble integrating with their family and needing some help with relationships. Or there might be people who are dealing with depression and anxiety. But I don't have any of these statistics to say whether that's higher or lower than the general population.
Right. I think the takeaway is, you know, it's like you mentioned, people have a lot of things going on and vision loss happens to be mm-hmm. one of them. And for so sure. I think overall the idea is that we're treating people, your clients may all have, or many of them may have something in common, but there are so many differences that mm-hmm. mental health challenges that they're experiencing are ones that, you know, are also common to many other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, definitely there are things that are different than, you know, others, but there are also a lot of things that are similar and commonalities between people. So sometimes I guess I hesitate to sort of kind of single out, you know, what are the mental health problems of, you know, the partially sighted and blind community, because that can really pathologize us. And, you know, it takes into consideration, I guess, maybe one of the biggest mental health problems for our community is ableism.
So more about, let's shift the focus more on, well, what's mm-hmm. going, you know, what's going wrong with the people in the community? And, mm-hmm. you know, instead, I think the direction that is more productive or helpful is to address the systemic issues. So maybe that's mm-hmm. where we can go, you know, in terms of, I think you did speak to it generally speaking, but, you know, are there specific, can you talk a little bit about the relationship between, let's say, barriers and, mm-hmm. and mental health or discrimination and mental health? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I would say that one of the biggest barriers for the partially sighted and blind community is lack of opportunities to employment. So for someone, you know, if they have their education, and they're now trying to get a job, and no matter how many resumes or applications they send out, they're still just getting no, no, no. It can be very frustrating. And it can be very easy to internalize that rejection into, you know, something's wrong with me. It could also lead to anger. And I mean, obviously some of that anger would be justified, but sometimes that anger can also get amplified and end up sort of being released onto other people. And so it really can have a direct connection between the experiences of ableism and barriers and what the individual person is feeling and thinking, you know, in their own lives.
Right. So it's it is an individual reaction. I'm sure some people, depending when they come up against challenges, they may feel sad, angry, all kinds of grief, I'm sure all kinds of feelings with not being able to have the same opportunities as others.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that makes more sense. I think I'm hopefully starting to get it a little bit more. Well, I guess in terms of mental health, the other thing that I would be curious about is, you know, what are some things that people can do? I mean, counseling is a great option.
Yes, and definitely. I think
more people should do it. But do you have any other strategies or things that people can do to take care of their mental health?
Definitely. There's lots of things that people can do. One of the things that I talk about with almost all of my clients is exercise or movement. Because there is a definite connection to how we feel in our physical body and how we feel in our mental, you know, mind. And this can be anything, can be anything starting from chair yoga, you know, up to running a marathon and anything in between. But just finding some regular exercise or movement can really help shift your mood. And then also kind of considering, you know, self-care strategies. What are things that you enjoy to reduce your stress or to let go when you're feeling those hard emotions? A lot of people like meditation or breathing exercises, and you can find lots of those on the web. And they can be very helpful both to do on a regular basis and to do when you're really having that moment of needing some help with a more kind of like urgent emotional need.
Yeah, that I think that the self-care piece, it's very individual. There are certain things that work for certain people, but in my experience, you kind of have to figure out what works for you as well.
For sure. Yeah. I think one thing is to kind of decide, like, what do you need right now? What type of self-care? So do you need something more energizing and energetic, or do you need something more calming and quiet? Do you need something more tactile or more sensory? Do you need to talk to a friend and have more social connection? But just trying to kind of tap into what is it that you sort of need in that moment. And again, there's always room for trial and experimenting to see what it is that, you know, really works for you.
I hope you don't mind me mentioning, I noticed on your website, you might have mentioned that you also enjoy engaging in exercise or other things like that. I saw that you have done a half marathon. Is that right?
Yes, I did. I did it with a combination of walking and running. So I didn't run the whole way. And even now, I still do the combination of walking and running. I've never made it fully completely to running, but it is something that I do enjoy. And I connected to one of the, you know, accessible recreation groups. I joined Achilles. And so besides the exercise, I also have found a great community there for social connection. And it's something that I look forward to all the time whenever I go for a group walk or run with Achilles.
Awesome. Do you have any other like groups, activities that you'd like to share?
I've definitely done yoga before. For a while, there was a Latin dance group that was going on, and unfortunately, the teacher wasn't able to continue long term. So now, once the pandemic is over, I'm going to look into some other dance studios to see if I can find some Latin dance classes. I like cats, and I love reading.
Do you have a cat?
I'm right now actually in between cats. I had a very old senior cat, and his time came in March. I think we're about ready to start looking for our next cat, but unfortunately, there's actually not as many cats available I guess because people have been adopting quite a few of them during the pandemic.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's sort of a mixed blessing. It's
yes.
great for the cats, but hopefully for you, you'll be able to, yes. to find yeah. your cat.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's another great mental health strategy, you know, is having animals around, you know, whether you're a cat person or a dog person or some other type of animal, you know, they can definitely provide a lot of love and companionship.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I feel like I have learned a lot about counseling sure. and your work and, you know, I feel like I've learned a little bit more about how to approach thinking about mental health in the context of ableism or disability. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you want to share or talk about before we wrap up?
I guess just going back to that point about that, you know, sometimes making that first inquiry can be the hardest part. A lot of people sometimes think that it's a weakness to ask for help. And I don't see it as a weakness. I actually see it as a strength. And so asking for help is really, you know, something not to be afraid of, but, you know, to look towards that things are going to be possible and that, you know, things might change once you ask for help.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Thank you so much for your time, Lisa.
No problem.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Special thanks to today's guest, our producer Troy Taylor, and the entire team at Balance for Blind Adults. This podcast is not a substitute for medical or professional advice. For more information about Balance for Blind Adults and our programs and services, please visit us at www.balancefba.org. Find us on LinkedIn or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Balance for Blind Adults.